Okay, so the next 2 weeks, we're going to focus on Parshat Balak, which is one of the weirdest parshiot in the Torah, to the point where the Gemara in Baba Batra, when it's describing the authors of every book in the Torah, describes that Moshe wrote Sifro, right, the Torah, right, Uparshat, right, Uparshat Sefer Bilam, right, and the book of Bilam, which it's not or Balak, I think it's Bilam, which according to the Ritva is some lost Sefer that we don't have, not a book of Tanakh, but some history book of that period. But according to many Mefarshim, it's just this parsha, because this parsha is, it's just odd. It is the only, it's basically the only unit in the Torah where the whole story takes place with no Jewish or, you know, proto-Jewish protagonist present, right? This entire, the Jews are at the core of the story, in the sense that Balak is petrified as he sees the Jews, and he asks Bilam to come and curse them, and they're constantly trying to curse them, but the Jews aren't present. No one is present, and therefore, the reason the Mefarshim know that this is called a separate book is because the Torah actually needs to tell you that, by the way, Moshe wrote this, even though he's not present, no Jew is present, he wrote it. But it's this very strange story that is here. Besides for that oddity, there is, you know, as we mentioned, last week, but we'll focus on really next week, you have in the middle of the story the entire incident with the donkey, with the talking donkey. Meaning, if you had to list weird moments in the Torah, the talking donkey scene is right up there as one of the weirdest. But the basic contours of the story are that the Jews, as we've seen, sort of the last few prakim, have started their battles. We didn't get into details, but they we'd started it. They are approaching Israel, and they face their first two major battles with Sihon and with Og. So they do have their first two victories, and as they're approaching Israel and they are conquering these superpowers that are on the way, Balak, who's the king of Moab, at that time panics, and he calls Bilam, who is this, we'll see what he is exactly, this prophet, this magician, wizard, sorcerer, whatever, to come and to curse them, to allow him to beat the Jews. And Bilam says, no, I can't do it, I can only do what God says. So the messengers go back to Balak, and then Balak sends them back, again. And he says, no, I can't do it, but, you know, let me see what God says. And God says, if you really want to, go, but you can only say what I want you to. So he goes, and then he has this whole incident with the donkey, where the donkey keeps ramming him into the wall. He doesn't realize why. Eventually, God reveals to him that there was an angel standing there with a sword. And he says, I don't understand, right? What, you know, what's going on? I'm sorry, whatever. And then he gets there and he tries to curse them once, twice, three times, four times. And each time it doesn't turn into a curse, it turns into a blessing. And then the fourth prophecy, it's really three blessings. The fourth prophecy isn't a blessing, it's a curse against Balak. Right? So it's really three blessings of the Jewish people and then a curse against Balak and the other nations, the foretelling of their doom. And that's the story. So there are many different parts of the story to talk about, but what I want to focus on today really is the connection between this story and the Mitzrayim story. Because one of the things that seems to emerge from this story is that this is Yetziat Mitzrayim times two, or what could have been. Because at this point, the Jews have finished. Right, Mitzrayim is gone, is behind them. We're at generation two, and now they're moving into the next stage of their existence, which is they're going to Canaan. But when you open up the story of Balak, suddenly you find yourself back in Mitzrayim. So if we open up the beginning of Balak, right, I put it here, number two, or you open up a chumash, whichever. Right, Balak says, "Vayar Balak ben Zippor kol asher asa Yisrael Amori." So Balak had seen what the Jews had done to Amori, to Sichon and Og, where they'd beaten these superpowers. Vayagar Moav v'pnei ha'amod kiravu. Vayakatz Moav v'pnei b'nei Yisrael. And the people of Moab feared the Jews tremendously because they were many. And they were disgusted by them. Moab was disgusted by Bnei Israel. Vayomer Moab el zeknei Midyan, ta yilachachu ha'kahal et kol sevivotenu, kilacho hashor et yerek ha'sadeh, uvalak ben zibor melech Moab v'edei. And Moab said to the elders of Midian, "Now the Jews will lick us up. They like an ox licks up the vegetation of the field." Vayishlach malachim el Bilam ben Beor Petora asher al hanahar eretz bnei Amo lekrolo lemor hine am yatzam mimitzrayim hine chisareina haretz v'hu yoshev mimuli. So they call. He sends messengers to Bilam. And he calls him and he says, "Look, this people has come out of Mitzrayim and they've covered the land and they're standing in front of me. They're opposite me. Vata lechana aralir amaze ki atzumu mimeni ulai uchalna kebo vagarshenu min haaretz ki yadati et asher tivarech mivarach vasher taor you are." And they say, and he says, "Come and curse them for me, because otherwise they're too powerful. Maybe if you curse them, I'll be able to strike them and drive them from the land, because I know that whoever you bless is blessed, and whoever you curse is cursed."
Question.
Yeah.
So this is, they've been wandering in the desert or wherever they are, for this is 38 years. So he still refers to them as a nation that's come out of Egypt. But don't the surrounding countries, I mean, they know that it doesn't take 38 years to go into Israel. What are they... Don't they think that makes the Jewish people less powerful? That they've been wandering around the
right. Country? So that is right. So that's the striking thing, is that, you know, the evidence in Chumash seems to be that despite it all, they're still known as the Am HaYatzah Mitzrayim. Right. That's how we use them. And I always, the way I sort of understand the Yarden story when they cross into the Yarden is that the Yarden story is not there as a new miracle. It's there to reinforce Mitzrayim, to remind people what happened 40 years ago. Because that's really... If you look in Az Yashir, right, Az Yashir tells you that the goal of... Right, people, we don't notice this because, again, we always read Chumash knowing what happened rather than what should have happened. In Az Yashir, it was supposed to be only a few weeks before they go into Israel. Right? So the... So if you look in Az Yashir, I'll skip to it. Did I even put it? No, I didn't put it here. But okay. But it connects to it anyways, right? In the middle of Az Yashir, it says that Az Nivhalu Alufei Edom, right? The leaders of Edom are afraid. Elei Moav Yechzemurad, the powerful ones in Moab are grabbed with trembling. Namogu Kol Yoshvei Kanaan, and all the people in Canaan have melted. Now those are the three, right? These are the nations we were just faced, right? Edom, who we went around their land, and now Moab, who we're fighting now, and then Canaan. Because the same path we take now was the path we were supposed to take 40 years before. And the miracle of the Kriyat Yamsuf was supposed to terrify everyone into submission before we got there. The miracle of this whole story is that despite the fact that 40 years have passed, you see that psychologically that's still where they are. And when Rahav says to Yoshua's spies, "By the way, everyone's still afraid," she says, "We remember Kriyat Yamsuf." Right? Everyone remembers that. And the Yarden just sort of invokes those memories. For whatever reason, it manages to keep the fear for 40 years. Right? You know, people, I don't know what it was they thought. They knew, you know, about that God had decreed that they would be there, and therefore it didn't minimize the fear, or, you know, they just assumed they were building up a society before they conquered. I don't know exactly what they were thinking, but clearly, it's Ya'am HaYatzami Mitzrayim. But it's not just the Mitzrayim point, right, which is striking, that yes, he still views this as the direct follow-up for Mitzrayim, but the language he uses is very Paro-esque. I mean, if you look at source one here, when Paro first decides to plot against the Jews, He says, Vayomer el amo, hine am b'nei Yisrael rav v'atzum mimenu. The Jews are more than we are. Right, now this word, right, this theme and the exact words appear in the Balak one. Right? There are too many of them. Rav who? There are too many. Havanit chakma lo pen yirbev ayati ki tikrena milchama v'nosaf gam hu also neinu v'necham banu v'ala min haaretz. Let's outwit them, because if there's too many of them, when war comes, they will be added to our enemies, and they'll fight us, and we'll be driven from the land. Now this is that's basically what Balak says, right? Let's drive them from the land, but he's not in their land yet, right? Garshenu min haaretz. Right, but that's the point, right? Is he assumes that the Jews are about to conquer his land, so he wants to drive them out of his land. Right, he already views them as in his land. He's afraid they're going to drive him out, so he wants to drive them out. So Paro has them build these. Right, he enslaves them. He torments them. He makes them build these cities. And the more they would cause them to suffer, the more they would have children. And they became, right, disgusted. Which is again, right? It's the same things. They see a populous nation, they get afraid. But what is what's the point here? And I think, and this is really the key to why this story is here, is this, it's meant to be Yetziat Mitzrayim 2, but to highlight the contrast rather than the similarities. Because last time we had a Paro figure. The Jews weren't out to get Paro. They just weren't. They were a people living in Mitzrayim, and he panicked, and he said, "I have to be evil to them," and therefore he made they were downtrodden, they were enslaved to prevent this theoretical possibility that they might conquer them. Here, this is the reality. They really are numerous. They really are out to get everybody, right? This is real. This is exactly what is happening. This isn't theoretical anymore. Now, maybe Moab, Midian are not the ones that are actually going to be fought, which he didn't realize. Right? In that sense, it's a false alarm, because Moab, had they not fought, we wouldn't have fought them, because Lot actually deserves the land. So it is a false alarm, but so in that sense, yes, Balak is not well placed, but it highlights the difference that 40 years earlier, or not 40 years, now we're not 40, we're 200 and some odd years, 250 years earlier, we weren't this big bad enemy. But now we've matured, we actually are, right? We are, there's a real threat, we pose a real threat to the people. Now we may not want to pose a threat to the people outside of Israel. It's different, it's not quite Canaan. In Canaan we really are the threat, we're going to drive them out of the land. Sichon and Moab, and Edom, we said to them, look, let us pass through your land, around your land, and it'll all be fine. We won't fight you. We just want to get through. Instead, they come to war, so we beat them. So it's similar to Paro in the sense that, okay, we're not actually fighting these people, but it highlights the difference, because this time we actually are the big bad enemy. Maybe Moab isn't the actual enemy, but Canaan is, and this is what we're going to do. We actually are going to drive them out of the land. And therefore, this story, by invoking Mitzrayim images, on the one hand, highlights the sort of eternity of our struggle against our enemies, where we're not actually fighting Sichon. We didn't want to fight Sichon. We didn't want to fight Moab. But our enemies always assume we are. But on the other hand, then we weren't in the state where we could fight them, and now we really are. Right? This is really where we are in life. So this story acts as a good introduction to the new stage in the Jews' life, where we actually are that enemy. We are that power that can come and can fight our enemies. Now, Chazal connect these stories in number 3. And Amar Abchia Bar Abba Amar Rav Simai, Shlosha Hayu Bo Toetza. When Paro wanted to enslave the Jews, he asked three people. Bilam, Iov, Yitro. Bilam and Iov and Yitro. Bilam, Sheyahatz, Neharag, Iov, Shadak, Nidon, Biyasirin, etc. Bilam, who gave the original advice to Paro to enslave the Jews, he was eventually killed in this battle. Rabbi Chazal are midrashically reading, saying Bilam lived 250 years, and Bilam was the same advisor to Paro. Right, that's, but this is what they're really saying. It's the same ethos, right? The same ethos that Bilam is going to give to Balak now, when he's going to try to harm the Jews, is exactly what Paro did. Now you have to ask the question, though: why? How do Chazal view Bilam in a terrible light? Right, he's evil. He's the worst. They're going to assume, and this is probably the simplest read of the Chumash, though it's not explicit, and the Ramban will actually deny it, that at the end, right after the failure to curse, the Bnot Midian actually do manage to make the Jews sin, which then leads to their death. They end up sleeping with the women, and then and worshipping Avodah Zarah, and 24,000 of them die. And Chazal say that it's Bilam's fault, right? Bilam gave this advice, right? When he failed to curse them, he came up with this new plan. But you have to ask the question, how did Chazal know that Bilam was so bad? If you just read the pshat of the psukim, Bilam says, I can't do anything that God says not to do. And then he says that again. And even when he goes, he ends up blessing them every time. So how bad is he? Right, how bad could he be? And as you see in this midrash, it's not just that Chazal say that he's bad in this story. They make him into this mythical figure who was the ultimate anti-Jew since the beginning. Right? He was the one who advised Paro. Right? Whether they mean that literally or not, what they're saying is that Bilam represents all that is wrong about our enemies. Where did Chazal get that notion? So here, and this is a sort of simple point that I heard from Rabbi Liebdag, and he always liked saying this. The key to this entire story and understanding why Bilam is so bad, it comes down to understanding the map. And that's it, is the map. Which is, Balak, just like Paro, as unfounded as it was, at least they're in their home territory, and they have the Jews present, and they're afraid of the Jews. Rational, irrational, whatever. Where does Balak live? And Balak lives. Oh, sorry, Bilam lives. Aram Naharayim. He lives in Mesopotamia. Right, this is a huge journey. Right? And these messengers keep going back and forth. This is not like Balak was afraid, so he went to his next door neighbor and said, come. Bilam schleps himself from Aram Naharayim, which is, right, so if you imagine the map, right, from Iraq or so, by foot and donkey, all the way to the south of it, south, sort of the south of Jordan, right? Moab is the south part of Jordan. So by foot, right? How long of a walk is that? I don't know. A week, right? A week walk. He comes. Then after all the curses that go wrong and turn into blessings, he sends him back. And then when it comes to Bnei Midian, we find Bilam back giving advice to Balak, which means of his own accord. First time he comes a 7 day or whatever walk, and then he's sent home in disgrace, and of his own volition, he then sets out again and comes back to Balak to come up with a new way to give Balak advice to kill the Jews, right? To have them sin. Which means that in this story, we actually learn about two different types of enemies that the Jews have, right? One, the contrast between Paro and Balak is number one, right? Is that both Paro and Balak, the similarities between them are they're both people with somewhat legitimate fears, right? Paro is less legitimate because the Jews are not trying to fight him. Balak is more legitimate because this time we actually are coming as a conquering force. But either way, at least the animosity that Paro and Balak have for the Jews seem to be because the Jews actually pose a threat, or at least in their minds pose a threat to them. That's one type of enemy that we face. But Chazal, by connecting Bilam to the Mitzrayim story, are saying, but by the way, in every story, there's the enemy, there's the rational enemy, or whatever, the relatively rational enemy, meaning the person who is actually afraid of us because we pose a threat to him. But then things are exacerbated because there are the Bilams in this world, the people who are just out to get us, just because they're out to get us. We're not a threat to them, right? They will, of their own accord, schlep to somewhere where they're not wanted, they're not needed, right? Just to find a way to hurt us. And that's Bilam, right? And Chazal are really saying, well, you know what, right? Point one is there's always the Paros and the Balaks of the world, sometimes more, sometimes less founded in their fears of us. And then there are the Bilams. They're the irrational anti-Semites who are just out there, who we have nothing to do with, who just hate us and will do whatever they need to. And that's all mixed in. You know, it's mixed in Mitzrayim. It's mixed in when we enter Eretz Israel. Right? This is just the Jewish reality. And Chazal, again, by connecting the Paro story and the Balak story, highlight both the contrast in terms of the fact, yes, now we actually are a real enemy, but also the similarities. There's also a certain level of irrational fear in it. There are certain people like Bilam who has nothing to do with whether we pose a threat. If they can find an excuse to be our enemies, great. Okay, and that's where we come. Now, so we have this Paro background. The second story that is invoked consistently here is not just Balak. It's not just Mitzrayim, it's also Avram. Right? The Avram story is invoked, specifically in the Brachot, right? Because Balak tells Bilam, I'm calling you because I know, Ed Asher Tivarech Mivarach, Basher Tar, you are. Whoever you bless will be blessed, whoever you curse will be cursed. Right? That's the undermining of Avram's bracha. Right? Whoever blesses you will be blessed, whoever curses you will be cursed. And that's essentially, that's what Bilam actually tells him. Right? When Bilam comes around to the truth in number four, he says, Ma ekov lo kabo el, ma zom lo zom Hashem. I can't curse what God hasn't cursed, and I can't make angry what God isn't angry at. Right? It's not me. I mean, Balak is flipping the Avram paradigm. Right, the Avram paradigm is the Jews are blessed and whoever helps the Jews is blessed. Balak says, no, Bilam, whoever you curse is cursed, whoever you bless is blessed. And Bilam flips it back at him and says, no. And that's the Avram paradigm. What's going to lead us into Mitzrayim? It's a paradigm we've set up a long time ago, which is, it's not about human beings, it's about God. And God has determined that the Jewish people are blessed. If you attack the Jews, it will turn on you. And that's how the story ends, right? Balak tries to curse the Jews. The fourth nevuah of Bilam is a curse of Balak. Right? I can't just curse people. So we enter Mitzrayim, we enter Canaan, not just bringing in the Mitzrayim paradigm, but also bringing in the Avram paradigm. We can't do that. Right? And he tells him again in 5, he says, this is just the way things are. Don't think you can change God's mind. Listen to me. God isn't a person that he can be tricked, or a human being who will change his mind. Will he say something and not do it? Or say something and not fulfill it? He blessed, and he's not taking it away. He's given a blessing, he's not taking, I can't turn the bracha back. So the second thing, I think, the reason this story is here, right? One reason this story is here is to teach us about the eternity of our enemies, right? There will always be the Paros and the Balaks, whether it's a rational fear or not. There'll always be people who we're in their land and we pose a threat, less, more, There's going to be that type of enemy. Two is there's always going to be the Bilams of the world. The ones who irrationally hate us, and they're going to be our enemies, and they're going to come from far off, even though we don't pose a threat to them. Number three that you need to understand as you're going into Israel is that our success depends in part on the avot, on the fact that our brachot are already built in. You can't, it's not up to a sorcerer like Bilam to reverse Avram's bracha, which is whoever is blessed, whoever blesses you will be blessed, whoever is cursed is, right, that you are the source of blessing. That's just the way the world is. Right? God has said, if you support the Jews, they'll be good for you. Don't try to reverse it. It doesn't work. And as you go into Israel, understanding our enemies and understanding what's behind us historically is really important. Right? All these messages are very critical as we come in. And I would add that it's not just for the Jews to learn the message, but it's for the non-Jews to learn it as well. Because the pasuk that I just read, again, Parshat Balak, or Parshat Bilam, Sefer Bilam, there are no Jews present. There are no Jews hearing this. What's amazing about this story is that all these theological lessons aren't actually happening for the sake of the Jews. They're happening for Balak. Balak is the one being told, you know, you're trying to change the destiny of the Jewish people, but it doesn't work. Avram was given a bracha. God said, if you support the Jews, you will be blessed. If you curse them, you'll be cursed. And I can't undo that. So these theological messages, while we reading the Torah learn it as Jews, when it happened, it was there to teach not the Jews, but the non-Jews. But one of the things we talked about a lot when we dealt with Shmod is that that was the point of Mitzrayim also. Right? Mitzrayim, the whole Mitzrayim story wasn't just about educating or helping the Jews, as it put in number 6. V'yadu Mitzrayim, k'ani Adonai, mintoti et yadi al Mitzrayim, v'otzeiti et b'nei Yisrael mitocham. God says that part of the reason that he performed all the miracles in Mitzrayim is so that Paro and the Mitzrayim will know that I am God. And that's sort of lesson 4, is that when God carries out punishment or his defense of, you know, punishment against our enemies or his defense of us against our enemies, he's not only trying to save us, he's also trying to educate the world and say, I am more powerful than your sorcerers. I am more powerful than your best laid plans. I'm smarter. If I want something to happen, it will. If I don't want it, it won't. So that's point 4 of why I think this story comes as we're going into Eretz Israel. And the fifth one, I think I have 6 totally here. Yeah, I have six lessons as we're going in. So we've done 4. Number 5 is, I think, the ethical lesson. And that is that one of the things the Jews are tasked with as a nation is maintaining holiness, but specifically the way that's framed is not just in a vacuum. Right? When we are, this is actually this week's parsha. Oh, there you go. God doesn't just say to us, look, be holy. When the Torah was given, there were specific nations who excelled at immorality and lack of ethics. And Hashem tells us, I want you to be unique. The two nations Hashem picks out are, consistently, Mitzrayim and Canaan. Right? The nation that you came from wasn't ethical, and the nation you're going to wasn't ethical, and you need to stand out. So invoking a Mitzrayim-like story as we're going into Canaan, we're going to Eretz Israel, makes sense, because it's not just God will protect you, and God will protect you from your enemies, and he'll educate your enemies about certain truths. It's also that part of the reason I took you out of Mitzrayim, and the part of the reason I'm putting you to Eretz Israel, is so that you should be unique and distinct from them, both of them. And that's what I put in 7. Vaydaber al-Nei Moshe l'Emor. Daber al-Bnei Yisrael v'amarta lehem, ani Adonai Eloheichem. Tell the Jewish people that I am Hashem, your God. Ki ma'asei Eretz Mitzrayim asher yishavtem ba lo ta'asu. The actions of Mitzrayim, where you used to dwell, don't act like them. וכמעשי ארץ כנען אשר אני מביא אתכם שם לא תעשו ובחוקותיהם לא תלכו. And what the people in Canaan do, the place where I'm going to bring you into, don't act like them either. So that's reason five. But that leads to the failure of this story. Because the beginning of Parshat Balak is all a raving success. Right? We have our enemies, they try to fight us, they try to curse us. God says, no, you can't curse them, I don't want you to curse them, it doesn't work. And Bilam eventually comes around, and instead of cursing, he blesses them. But then, let's just take it the way Chazal do. Bilam tells Balak, I have a secret. If you want to succeed, the way to succeed is not to directly confront the Jews. It's to make them implode by making sure that they fail to live up to their own values, in which case God will not be on their side. Right? Ma kavo lo kavo el, I can't curse them, but if you jump down to 12, I'll just do this now, after the Jews sin with the Benot Midian, it's only stopped by Pinchas. Right? Pinchas comes and he takes the spear and he sticks it through Zimri and Cusbi in the middle of their act of this sexual impropriety. But in number 12, the pasuk says as follows: Vayavo achar ish Yisrael el hakuba, vayedkor shnehem et ish Yisrael v'reisha el kavata, v'teetzar magifa me'al b'nei Yisrael. Pinchas ends it by striking them in the kuba. Right, which is sort of a weird word for stomach. And he strikes Zimri, the man, and the woman, in Cusbi, el kavata, in her innards. But the word kavata is the same word as what Bilam said. Ma'ekov lo kavo gael. I can't curse what God hasn't cursed. But what the Torah seems to be implying is I can't curse them as long as God blesses them. But if they curse themselves, or if they succumb to the culture, so then they will be cursed. And the only way to stop the curse is to stop the sin. So Pinchas ends it by striking it bikavata. But the imagery that the Chumash is getting at is, remember, leaving Mitzrayim and going to Canaan isn't just because God likes you. It's because he has a mission for you. He wants you to be distinct. And if you aren't, if you maintain your level of morality, so then, ma'akov lo kavo el. God won't curse you, and no one else can curse you either. But if you fail morally, you follow ma'ase eretz Mitzrayim and ma'ase Kenan, the people that you left and the people you're coming into, so then your enemies don't have to fight you. God will do it for him. Will do it for them, because it depends on a certain level of morality. And I think that this notion is borne out very much by Chazal here. Because if you go back to number 7, there are many, many different arayot, many different sexually, improper acts that are listed in Kedoshim as the things the Jews have to maintain. But in Yud Zayin, you get one which is picked out as being particularly bad. It's called Zima. It's called immorality. Ervad isha uvita lo tigale et bat binav et bat bita lo tikach legalot ervata shara hina zimahi. One is people who sleep with multiple generations, right? With mothers, daughters, grandmothers, granddaughters. That's zima. And the second is in 8, al techalel et bitcha lahaznotav lo tizna haaretz umalaha aretz zima, is people who give away their daughters for promiscuity. Right, don't desecrate your daughter to be a zonah and fill the land with znut. And again, in number 9, Isha yikir yikachet isha vet ima zima hi ba'ish yisrofu tovet hen lo yezima v'tochichem. And I think the common denominator between those two sins, right? One, this multiple generation znut, and the giving over your daughters to be prostitutes, is this notion of total sexual abandon, right? They're using their children, right? You know, there's no, like, there's a total breakdown in the family, and they're using their children for immorality. It shows a total breakdown, right? It's not, the other arayot don't have this generational aspect. Both of these do, right? One, it's both the parent and the child are involved in the immorality, and the second one, it's the parent is actually instigating it. Those are sort of picked out as being the ones which are zima, the worst, the ones which are the paradigms of immorality. But if you think about it, that's how the Jews fail here. Because Midian gives over their daughters. It's not just, it's not the women go out of their own accord. It was a planned immorality. If you can, they wanted to ensnare the Jews. So how do they do it? The nation makes a decision. We are going to seduce them. They send out their children. Right? That's the way it's described. They send out their daughters. And the Jews fail, right? If this is the ultimate zima, it's the ultimate, case of us giving into our values, or giving up on our values, rather. The fact that we gave up, that we were seduced by this planned multi-generational znut, is evidence that, right, we have fallen prey to Matzei Eretz Mitzrayim and Matzei Kanan. And the Gemara, right? It's clear. The story of the failure in Midian is one of lo al techalel bitcha lahaznota, of a planned, right, parents sending out their children, right, to using promiscuity as a weapon. But the truth is that the Gemara strikingly actually picks up the other one as well. This notion of multiple generations involved in the act itself, in number 10. And this is how it describes Bilam telling Balak what to do. Hini olech lami. I'm going home. But lichai yatzecha sheyaseh ha'am hazeh la'amecha. Let me tell you what this people, the Jews, are going to do to you. Amcha l'am hazeh mi boyle. He said, your nation, it's this nation. So Omer av Abba Bar Kahana ka'adam shemekalel ratzmo v'tolek l'ato ba'achirim. Okay. He didn't want to say... Right, he wanted to sort of say it in a circumspect way. He didn't want to talk about the punishment itself. Okay, Amar Lahem, and he said to him, Eloheihem shel elu sone zimahu. Right, and the Gemara picks up on it. It's this word. It's not just God doesn't like immorality. He doesn't like zima. I mean, more than he doesn't like immorality, he doesn't like planned immorality. He doesn't like when it becomes so much a part of a culture that multiple generations are involved at the same time. Right, that's really what both of them are about. Right, when parents and children can be involved in the same act, or alternatively, parents can send their children out. It's not just they happen to be immoral, it's planned, it's societal. So go, and that's the two that are zima. And the Gemara picks up on zima. The heim mit avim l'klei pishtan, and the Jews are greedy. And they want, right, they want expensive clothes. Bo bas yechai tzas, let me give you advice. Aselam klaim, voshiv behen zonot, right, put these prostitutes out. And the elder ones, elderly women will be outside, and the younger women inside. The elderly women on the outside will sell them cheap, expensive clothing. Right, give them a good deal. Right, play on their greed, or whatever. And then the younger women will be inside. So they made, right, these, they set these up. And they put the prostitutes inside. So when the Jews would celebrate and they'd be eating and they'd go out to shop, the elder woman would say, don't you want this good, expensive clothing? So what they would do is, the elderly woman on the outside would give them the price. But then, as they approach, the younger woman who's on the inside would say, by the way, I have a sale, right? It's $100 outside, but if you come inside, we're having a sale, right? This is the outlet price is on the inside, it's $50. Shtayim v'shalosh pamim, this would happen two or three times. V'acher kach, omeret lo, hare at tiven bayit, shei bror latzmecha. At that point, they'll say, oh, you know what? You've come shop by us a few times. You're like a household. Just come, choose whatever you want. V'tzar tzuri shel yayin amoni munach. That's a lie. And then, you know, like, you know, they give, you know, you go to, like, the Nespresso store, they'll give you free coffee. So here they give you free wine, right? It's even, right, freebies with alcohol, right? They're getting, right, they're, right, it's a sale, it's alcohol, right? They're bringing them in. Where you were still allowed to drink the wine of non-Jews. Do you want wine? Kevin Sheshata Barbo, right? Once you've, right, you're drunk, right? Right, they that would you know that would get them sexually inclined. Amar la shmili, she would say, "Listen to me, Otzia Yira Tamito Chegash." She would take out the avodah zarah from her, right, that she had been hiding in her inner cloak. Amar lo avod lazeh, and said, "Worship it." Amar lo alo yudiani, but I'm a Jew. Amar lo umaych bat lacha, what do you care? Klum mevakshim imchay lepior, and this was Baal Peor, which you would just defecate in front of. Hu eni yodesh avodah tabekach, he didn't realize this was the proper service. V'lo od el she'eni merachatcha ad she'techpor b'torat Moshe Rabcha, and I won't leave you alone until you deny the whole Torah. Shneamar heima ba'u Baal Peor v'inazru leboshet v'yush kutzim b'havam. And Rashi summarizes the upshot of this story, which is in number 11. V'shem Yishamuka, why do you tell us who the woman is who was killed? The fact that she was a princess, Kasbi Batsur. Lo diachas neitem shel midyanim shefkiru bat melech leznut kedei lahachdid Yisrael. They were willing to give up their princess just to make the Jews fail. What I think Chazal is getting at with this story, where right, it combines the two elements of Zima. Right? One is this notion of multiple generations involved in it, and two, the notion of Znut, right, of encouraging children to be involved in it, is that Midian represented the worst of Maseh Eretz Mitzrayim, Maseh Kenan. Not just people who happen to sin, a culture of institutionalized immorality. This story is put here to remind us that you have to be different. This institutionalized morality, in immorality, where not just they sinned, but it was a they would weaponize sin. Right? They were willing to give up their children. Everyone was involved in planning it. And that can lead to not just Nut, but Avodah Zarah. If you give in to that, you've given up, as it says, Ashetichbar B'Torat Moshe. That's giving up on who you are. And if you do that, you don't deserve to go into Israel. Just like you wouldn't have deserved to leave Mitzrayim. So I think message 5 here is this story is here because of the failure. Right? The first 4 lessons were about the success. Right? As long as you maintain your purity and you are distinct, so then you will beat all your enemies. You'll beat your pragmatic enemies like Paro and Balak. And you'll beat those enemies who just hate you because you're Jews, like Bilam. And no one will be able to curse you, because the bracha of Avram will protect you. All that's true. And your experience won't just educate you, it'll educate the whole world. It'll educate Mitzrayim, it'll educate Balak about the truths of God's relationship with the Jewish people. Great. But all that is predicated on you not undermining yourself. But if you undermine yourself, right, there are 2 cultures that I want you to be distinct from. One is Mitzrayim and 2 is Canaan. What was unique about those cultures was not just that they were immoral, but that it was part of the culture. It was institutionalized to the point where you see it in this story. They're willing to weaponize their own children's innocence to make the Jews fail. But the Jews do fail. And then, after all of Bilam's protesting that God would never curse the Jews, God curses the Jews and he kills them. Right, 24,000 people die as long as the sin is going on. Because the 5th lesson of this unit is that all of that success and all those miracles, both in Mitzrayim and Canaan, hang on you maintaining your difference from the people that you left and the people you're going into. If you don't, if they try to ensnare you and you succumb, then you're no better than them. If you're no better than them, then everything I said before is out the window. God will only protect you as long as you deserve it. If you don't deserve it, then all your worst fears, all the things that I kept away from you, all those terrible curses I managed to avoid, right? I helped you avoid. I only helped you avoid because you deserved to live. You deserved to thrive. If you don't, then it won't work. So I think lesson 5 is that this story is equally about the success of the Jews fending off danger in the first 4, right? The first 4 lessons, but it's also about the failure that our enemies can't touch us as long as we deserve to be in Eretz Israel. If we don't deserve it, if we become just like the Mitzrayim and the Canaanim, then we wouldn't have deserved to leave Mitzrayim, and we don't deserve to go into Canaan. So if they If you succumb to their culture, then why am I bringing you in? And all the things that were impossible a minute ago, right? That nothing could happen. The most powerful sorcerer in the world could curse you and it would turn into a bracha. The second you undermine your own value system, it's all out the window. So it's a warning as they go in. The sixth lesson, this is the last one, is that we already mentioned this last week, that the period of the 40th year is a transition from when Moshe acts on our behalf to save the Jews to when God acts by himself, because Moshe's out of the picture. This whole story takes place, as I said, with no Moshe, right? Moshe isn't present. It's a perfect story because the parallel to Mitzrayim highlights the difference. The last time we had Paro, God saved us but used Moshe. This time we have Paro, a Paro-like figure, Balak, and God does it by himself. Moshe's out of the picture. Right, so lesson six, and the reason this is here is because it reminds us of the difference, and this is a point from Ray Helfgott. I just put a summary in 13. That the story of the 40th year is how Moshe phases out of the picture and God can save us by himself. And then lesson 6b, or 7, however you want to do it, is that there will be people involved, because the Jews do have to step up to the plate, but the people aren't going to be Moshe. It's God without Moshe, and it's people who are not Moshe. So he points out that both of these are present in the story. The first half of the story, God saves us by himself. The second half of the story, a person saves us from sin, but it's not Moshe anymore, it's Pinchas. And the transition period, as we go into Canaan, needs to highlight both of those things, that God acts now without Moshe, and the people who are involved are no longer Moshe. They have to be the next generation who are going into the land. They need to take responsibility for themselves. And that's what I think the Gemara highlights in number 4, because the Gemara puts this very, makes a very, tells a story about how this happened, and it really drives this point home. And it says, "Vayomer Moshe el Shoftei Yisrael, halach shifto shel Shimon etzel Zimri ben Salu." So this is how it happened. Zimri, the people of Shimon, went to their nasi, went to Zimri. Amr lo, hein danin dinin nefashot v'ata yoshev v'shotek. And he said, "Look, we're being killed, and you're just being silent." So Maasa Amad v'kibetz Hashem v'arba'a elef Mishrael. Zimri got 24,000 people of Shimon. V'halach etzel Kazbi, and he went to this princess Kazbi. Amr lo yashmi ili. And he said, "Listen to me, right? Be with me." Amra lo bat melachani v'chein siva li abba lo tishmi el lagadol shebehem. She said, "Look, I'm a princess, and my father said if you're going to sleep with one of the Jews, it better be an important one." Amra lo afani nasi shevetu, afu nasi shevetu. He said, "That's okay. I'm a prince. V'lo el shu gadol mimenu shehu sheni lebeten v'hu shlishi lebeten, and I'm more important than Moshe because he is from Levi, who is the third born child of Yaakov, and I'm the prince of the second Shevet. I'm from Shimon. So your father said, find the most important person. I'm right up there." Tafsa biblorio, tav evietz al Moshe. And she, right, he takes her by her hair, right, which is like a non-Jewish haircut. That's specifically what it is, and brings her to Moshe. Amrlo ben Amram. And he says, "Child of Amram, zu asuro muteret. Can I sleep with her or not? Vim tomar asura. And if you think it's forbidden, Bat Yitro Mihi Tirelach, how'd you marry a non-Jewish woman? You married Tzipora. Nit alma mimenu halacha." And Moshe forgot what to do. He forgot the halacha. And go kulam bivchiyah. So everyone starts crying because Moshe doesn't know what to do. Right? If we don't have Moshe, we have nothing. Hainu dechtiv eima bochim betachom oed. And that's why everyone's crying. Uktiv. And at that moment it says, Vayar Pinchas ben Elazar, that Pinchas sees. Mara'a, what did Pinchas see? Amarav Rasam Maasev and Iskar Lachai saw the story of the incident and he remembered what to do. Amar lo, Achi Avi Abba. So he said to Moshe, his great uncle, right? Achi Avi Abba, my great uncle. Lo kachli matani beret chamer sinai. Didn't you teach me that Abola and Achrit Kaneim Bogimbo, that if someone sleeps with a non-Jewish woman, the zealous ones can strike him? Amar lo, he said, you're right. Kraina de Igrita, the one who reads the letter, Iulavi Parvanka, he should fulfill the message in it. And the story that the Gemara sort of, dramatizes is that Moshe should be the one to act. Everyone expected Moshe to act. And when he says, I can't do it, everyone panics. And Pinchas says, but didn't you teach us how to deal with this? And Moshe passes on the baton. He says, you're right. But you gave me the message, it's your turn. And I think this story is here for both components of it, right? That here we have God protecting the Jews without Moshe's help. And when a person steps up to the plate, it's not Moshe anymore, it's the next generation. So I think the story of Balak, for the six or seven reasons that I've listed, is this transition period that's supposed to highlight what the second generation's Mitzrayim is like. Right? So just to review them, one is, yes, Paro and Balak are similar. Right? We always have enemies who are afraid because we actually pose a threat. But on the other hand, this is different, because in Mitzrayim we didn't pose a threat. But the fact that this story is happening again, but this time we actually are in the middle of conquest, highlights how much we've come. Point two is that as much as there are the Paros and the Balaks of this world, there's also the Bilams, right? The people who hate us irrationally and will hate us whether or not we pose a direct threat to them. The third point is that we're successful in part because God promised it to Avram, and that's immutable. Point four is that this is not just for us to learn. This is a message to the nations of the world, and that's why the target audience of the Mitzrayim story was as much the Mitzrayim as it was the Jews. And in the case of Balak, it was only Balak because the Jews weren't even there. Message five is that that's all true as long as we maintain our distinction, both from Mitzrayim and from Canaan. But if we buy into their institutionalized immorality, then all bets are off. And therefore, even though Ma'akov lo kabo el, right, that God, Ma'akov lo kabo el, the Bilam can't curse us, we will have our own kavo, right? We'll have our own keva, we'll have our own curse. If we buy into it and we succumb to it, so then it's all off, because it's conditional on us remaining distinct from the enemy that we left and the enemy we're coming to, who aren't just our physical enemies, but represent a different culture. And then 6a and b, which is, as we're going into Israel, the terms of going in are different. One is that God can do it without Moshe, which is why we have this story where Moshe isn't even present. And then 6b, which is when it is necessary for a person to step up to the plate, that person isn't Moshe, it's Pinchas. Because as we're going into Israel, that's what's different, is that God acts independently of a messenger, and the human beings have to act for themselves without Moshe. It has to be the second generation. And that's why I think the story of Balak is placed at this juncture in the 40th year, because its comparisons and its contrast to the Mitzrayim story, as well as the way in which God is represented, Moshe is represented, and the new leaders are represented, acts as a transition to remind us why we're going to Israel, why we deserve to go into Israel, what we need to do, the fact that God will continue to protect us with or without Moshe, and the fact that Moshe is gone, so when there needs to be human activity, it needs to be us stepping up to the plate and not him. And that's, I think, the at least seven lessons that the Balak episode tells us here at this juncture, after our first battles, but right before the actual entrance into Eretz Israel.